Well, welcome everybody to our lunchtime presentation, and a big welcome back to the CFO of the Walt Disney Company, Tom Staggs. We'll keep with the same format, a nice little Q&A. I have several questions prepared.
Does that format include protesters in the middle?
It does not include any protesters that I'm aware of, but if any arise, I will personally take care of them. I'm ready. What I thought I'd do is go through a few questions I had, and then we'll turn it over to the audience. I'm sure there's plenty out there. The first one is pretty easy and pretty broad. You've come through a couple of just fantastic years. You've beat street expectations significantly on the earnings. You've seen a turnaround in a lot of key properties. You've seen sustained growth in places like cable networks. Seen a little volatility in the film business, but you've got some good films out in the market and more on the way. You sounded pretty upbeat and bullish as you started the new fiscal year, which now you're well into the first quarter. When you reported Q4 earnings just a couple of weeks ago, maybe just give us a broad update on how you feel here as you start the year.
Well, I mean, I think you summarized it well. We're certainly pleased with the last 3 years, and we've done double-digit earnings growth, and our return on invested capital has come up, and the things that we said we wanted to do have largely transpired, but we're anything but complacent. And one of the things that last year threw into stark relief is that, you know, the making sure that the creative processes are right and that the creative output is strong is, you know, a critical thing for our company. And that's one of the things that we're really most focused on. It's why we wanted to start with nothing else to get people's attention, but start with the Narnia trailer, not just because we want to sell tickets for Friday, but, franchises like this are exactly the kind of thing that we think that we should be investing in and focused on. We have this, with our partners at Walden Media, we've got 7 books to mine for movies. We're hoping that the first one is big and the buzz is good, so we're not making any projections at all, but it certainly seems to be positioned just right, and the tracking looks great there. But, you know, as we sort of survey the company, we feel very good about the momentum that we're seeing in the individual businesses. And when we step back and look at what's going on in the broader environment, we also feel like we're in relatively good shape because, you know, we've talked a lot about all the changes that are going on out there in technology and in the environment, and what they add up to, first and foremost, at least in our minds, is an expanding consumer choice and expanding capability of reaching consumers in new ways. And while that may in fact impact existing business models, we also think that the bias is towards improved ability to reach people and improved ability to market our products. And so we think that what underlies that is the potential for growth. Deals like the iPod deal that we did, and we noticed yesterday that NBC followed suit, are sort of examples, albeit a small one, of how we can find new ways to reach consumers. And we've been asked a lot about, you know, the financial trade-offs there, but we didn't look at that deal as, gee, what is the cannibalistic effect? In fact, we expected it to be the opposite, and so far that seems to be the case. The ratings of the shows that are covered by the iPod deal have actually increased since we've done that. Now there's been 800 and some thousand downloads, so it's not like, you know, we've sold one to every man, woman, and child in the country, but we think the economics hold up even if it isn't market expanding, and at the end of the day, it looks like it is. So we also think that what we're seeing in the environment from a technological standpoint potentially offers new ways for us to enter some of the international markets that we've talked about as being so important, and hopefully accelerates the time that it takes to have those markets become significant. We think that the company, and when you look at that environment of increasing choice, we feel very good about the brands that we have that can cut through the clutter and allow us to establish ourselves on platforms. We do get calls from people when they've got new platform ideas, new distribution opportunities. They want the content that we make to help drive the platforms. We think that will continue. And so from that standpoint, we think especially the Disney and ESPN brands leave us very well positioned. The other businesses, I mentioned content at the outset. If we continue to make good content and really focus on investing in content, which we plan to do, then we can drive the other businesses as well. So the Narnia premiere, by the way, is starting in about an hour in London. It's probably too late to make it, so you're stuck with me at this point. But I just hung up with Bob as he was going over to do the. We drew straws, and I won, and I got you guys, and he's doing the premiere with Prince Charles. So, so we were just doing the general update, and he said, "It sounds like things are going just fine." I said, "I think things are going just fine." So, we feel good.
Excellent. Let's drill down a little bit on the theme parks, if we could, for a minute. That seems to be the one place. Whether I guess there's some skepticism still out on the street in terms of how you can grow through the rising pension costs that you talked about before. I think you all mentioned on the call that you could raise margins despite that this year, and I think a lot of people professed surprise. It seems to me like the year is going to be based on volume growth and pricing, that Hong Kong and the positive flip on the cost and the royalty will offset the pension cost for you. So maybe you could talk about the dynamics of what's coming in, what's going out, and what's going to be the key driver of theme parks for 2006.
Sure. And let me talk first at a slightly more macro level, and then I'll try to drill down a little bit and give you a little bit of color on what we see. But at the macro level, I talked about being well-positioned for changes in the environment. And I'm not sure people fully appreciate the extent to which our theme park business is a business that is fundamentally protected in that way. It's not a business that's going to suddenly be digitized. And you're not going to supplant the theme park experience. And at the same time, it's a business that I think that we enjoy a substantial and sustainable competitive advantage in. Just the size, scope, and brand power of the Disney theme park experience is really something that is quite strong, and it is something that I don't think is threatened by what's going on out there in the environment. So that's another piece of good news for us. On the more micro level, I think if you boil it down, clearly the fact that we had in the range of $100 million of pre-opening costs associated with Hong Kong Disneyland last year, that helps us somewhat on a margin basis. What we've tried to do to make it as straightforward as it can be is try to talk apples to apples to when we set the margin goal of 20% a couple of years ago. And that was on the basis of before we had consolidation of the international parks, et cetera. And on that basis, we improved a couple hundred basis points in margin this last year. But obviously, the pre-opening expense being not there in 06 doesn't affect that analysis. We see the lift that we think we can drive from the 50th anniversary celebration and the volumes associated with that as being something that can offset. Now, pension and post-retirement medical for the company as a whole is going to go up $148 million next year. And I think you'd be right to assume that 65-70% of that is shouldered by the theme park. So they do have that headwind. But part of the reason I also think we have a competitive advantage in this business is I think we have an extraordinary management team, and they are focused on making sure they not only deliver on the guest experience promise, the Disney brand, but also do it in the most efficient way possible. And they are constantly at work at that. We think there's still opportunities there. So you'll see some cost efficiency, and you'll see some, barring any downturn, you'll see some upside on the revenue side that will result in further expansion of the margin this year. If you look out to the end of when we said we'd get to 20%, if you just boil it down in stark terms, really what you're talking about is revenues need to grow about a point and a half, percentage point and a half higher than costs over that period of time for the unconsolidated business. Bear in mind that we also have the option expense and total stock-related expense that impacts us. But you know, putting that aside for a second, the you know, we believe that modest growth in the cost base is something that's achievable, even given the upward pressure in benefits, healthcare costs, et cetera. And if you look at our pricing over the years, we've pretty much tracked the leisure and entertainment index, which has tended to be a bit ahead of inflation, 7,500 basis points ahead of inflation, generally. And we've all, you also could take a look at the way that we've grown attendance, and there's the trend line that cuts through the cyclicality is that there's a couple of percentage points of overall attendance growth that we've experienced, notwithstanding recovery, as I said. And I think that's also something that we can continue to achieve. And we put those together, and when we boil it down, we think that that point and a half differential between revenue growth and cost growth is something that's achievable. And so we feel good about that goal that we've set out. It takes, you know, constant focus by the management team, but as I said, I think we've got exactly the right people doing that for us.
And you have good visibility on the cost structure now that you've got the Orlando union contracts.
We've got increased visibility there. We've got the most substantial portion of union contracts done, and those were resolved in a way that I think is good for both sides on that. So I feel very good about our theme park business. It's also, you know, we invested last year $725 million in capital in the domestic parks business. We invested a little over $700 million in the international parks on a fully consolidated basis. I think that, you know, the domestic capital expenditures in 2006 will be up a little bit, but still in the neighborhood of $800 million or so. The international parks capital expenditures will obviously come down quite a bit, having finished the initial build-out of Hong Kong Disneyland. There's still some investment going on in Paris and some follow-on investment in Hong Kong. But we're looking at a business that, as we've said before, after that investment, still capable of driving $1 billion plus of free cash flow after tax. And I think we're in good shape there.
And you have a major new attraction opening. Is it later this year with Expedition Everest?
Opens in the spring, and that looks like a great ride. And what it does is rounds out even more the Animal Kingdom as a, you know, extra day experience. Remember that we put out the Magic Your Way ticketing plan that really is designed to motivate people to extend their length of stay. And when we're able to do that, we really capture a much greater share of people's vacation wallets. And we think that that is part of the revenue upside that we've talked about. And, you know, adding this attraction to Animal Kingdom, I think, helps us in that regard.
Okay. Well, I know that you're not going to answer any questions on where the Pixar deal potentially currently stands, or any comment about that report I wrote a few months ago about why it would make such great sense for you to actually just go the whole hog and buy Pixar or Knight Ridder. So,
well, I sold some papers to Knight Ridder a few years.
Exactly, and you actually made money on that stock. Congratulations, one of the few. So what I will ask you though is why the animation business is really so important. I mean, it's at the top of the company's list in terms of strategic goals. What it's the one thing that really needs to be done and correctly, because it just is pervasive throughout the whole company. Can you talk about that?
You're right. Notwithstanding whatever distribution deal we do or don't end up with Pixar, the most important thing and the most important focus for us is making sure that we're getting animation right. And the reason it's important is if you look at our company, if you look at our consumer products, if you look at our theme parks, much of the equity in those properties comes out of animation. And so you're seeing us both in feature animation and in television animation really focusing on organizing for and focusing on driving success there. So we are prepared to invest in animation. We think it is a core property and a core competency of the company that we can build up further. Now, the good news is that Chicken Little is a very big step in the right direction. We don't put Chicken Little out and want to stand up and say, hey, we've arrived. We think that that's one of those, the creative endeavor is something that you just have to constantly work at. But we have the legacy, we have the set of properties, we have the Pixar sequels, we have the nucleus around which we are well positioned to continue to attract the right talent, to continue to put out the right films, et cetera. And as for those of you who have seen Chicken Little, I think you can appreciate the step forward we've taken in terms of the animation capabilities and the look and the feel. If you saw it in 3D, all the better. If you haven't gone yet, I wouldn't be offended if you stood up and went right now. But the as I said, it's a very big step in the right direction, and we're going to continue to focus on that. And it's one of the things that Bob has established. I can talk louder. That Bob has established as a key priority for the company. We're playing with those dials, Andrew.
At the same time that you're investing capital in animation, you're taking capital out of some of the live action. I mean, you've still got some big live action movies, for example, this year coming out with Pirates of the Caribbean, but just frame that strategy just a little bit.
Well, it's really about, we have brought the investment down over the past couple of years, and certainly with the reorganization of Miramax, we've taken a big step in that direction. So the investment in Miramax is going to be less than half of what it was just a couple of years ago, and it's about focusing our strategy in live action film in the areas where we think that we have the opportunity for the most dependable returns, and that where we have the most opportunity to create properties that can reverberate throughout the company. So Narnia is a terrific example of a property that we think has franchise potential. The books are there. The sequel potential is established. We really do have a great partner in Walden Media in that, and they've done a spectacular job. So we're very pleased, and that's exactly the kind of thing that we like to do. And Pirates of the Caribbean is exactly the kind of thing that we like to do. We've got, they're obviously very expensive sequels, but we think that the return proposition with Pirates 2 and Pirates 3, which is also in production, is very good. So if you look at the balance sheet over the last couple of years, if you look at net investment in film and television, you've seen it come down some. You've seen a source of funds last year and this year, $500 million actually, in 2005. I think we've come largely through that trend. Pirates 2 and 3 are expensive films. We're investing in those, so I'm not looking for that to necessarily be a source of funds this year. But I think that the investment focusing on those properties, focusing on Disney franchise films. If you look at the live action film business for us over the last 10 years, the Disney-branded films are very strong double-digit returns, very consistently. It doesn't mean that we are saying we're only going to make Disney-branded films. We want to make sure that we are a player at a critical mass level in the film business, but we are going to really pick our spots when we're outside the Disney brand, because we know that it's a somewhat different risk profile. There are good pictures to make, and there are producers and directors that we can partner with there that we think we can do well with. If you look at the Bruckheimer films, we've actually done quite well there through that relationship as well. Now, lately he's been doing a lot of Disney branded, so we kind of get a double plus from that. The good news is that the creative community, I think, gets the strength of the Disney brand and is showing a lot of interest in those kind of projects. So, our goal is to try to make sure that the studio is a vibrant creative engine inside the company, and that it operates on a basis that the returns make sense, even on a standalone basis, and then the way they ripple through the company is upside from there.
Investors have been hyper-focused, obviously, over the near term on DVD sell-through falling off, and I think it wasn't that good of a year for you either, but that may have been related more to the slate than actual unit sell-through. Give us your thoughts on, where do you think the market is right now?
Yeah, I think in fairness, we've had disappointing results from the live-action slate for the last 2 years, and that we're feeling, we felt it last year in DVD, and we're going to feel it for the first part of this year in DVD. And so, I look at the first quarter in the studio, and I know that, we're going to be off of the pace that that we set last year by a fair amount. But having said that, there are a couple things going on in the business overall that also have an impact. The given sort of average sell-through rate for a film of a certain box office was down about 10%. So for a given level of success in theatrical, the industry as a whole saw about 10% fewer units sold through. this last year versus the prior year. And so that obviously has an impact. Through the end of October, we've talked about this a little bit, there were about 10,000 new DVD titles released. And you know, less than about 4% of those were theatrical films. There were more full season sets of television shows on DVD released in the year than there were theatrical films. And so there's clutter in the marketplace. The rest of the DVDs, by the way, were all Baby Einstein, so that was, it was okay. Not really, but that business has been growing exceptionally well for us. So we're seeing it on the other side. The growth is helping us in other ways. But you know, I think that that really even sharpens our focus on where we invest our money in film and how we market those films. So,
talk about ancillary distribution platforms, or next gen, it's a better way to say it. I mean, as you go through your long-term planning, is it too early to put those kinds of things like, you know, HD releases of the libraries, or, you know, across portable devices, is it too early to put anything into your forecast?
Well, I think that it's a little early to make, you know, bold predictions about exactly what that will look like or what the impact will be. I think that it contributes to the constant refreshment and realization of the value of the library over time and the value of the new releases. HD is a very big deal for us. It's made a bigger deal because HD is so important to sports, and it's a big part of what we're doing with ESPN. But it's also, you know, I think it's about 14% or 15% of homes now have some HD capability, and that number promises to grow over this holiday period. And one of the things that, you know, I think, by the way, ESPN fans are sort of, I think it's 25% or 30% more likely to have HD sets than others, which just, I guess just means that guys like big television sets. But the you know, that capability, which ESPN has been investing in for a while, we think is a big deal to its business model. The ancillary revenue streams, whether it comes from mobile or broadband or HD, we think are going to be quite important. I have a hard time pinning exactly when they start to really move the needle or you know, replace, you know, other forms, but the promise is there. And as I said before, a lot of this seems to expand the potential marketplace. HD homes watch more TV than homes that don't have HD. And we're also finding, I had dinner with Mike Shaw, our head of sales, last night. When he's got advertisers who deliver him HD ads, people are watching the ads more frequently. I don't know, right now they're differentiated, but so that may be part of the effect. But the interest in television is up. People are watching more television, 20% more television today than they were 10 years ago. So if we continue to deliver the product and we continue to deliver it in ways that take advantage of the new capabilities, whether it's technical for the viewing experience, or it's taking advantage of technology that gives new viewing opportunities, mobile, wireless. You know, if you're bored right now, you could be watching. If you had an ESPN phone, you could be catching up on highlights at SportsCenter. So we're going to have to be more interesting because people will be competing that way. But you know, those are market expanding opportunities we think we're well positioned for.
I should have said actually Blu-ray DVD, but never pass up a chance to give Sony a plug. But are you going to have Blu-ray DVDs in the market next year? Are you going to have
I think that
presence.
It looks like we'll be getting to the point where the HD stuff will become available. Remember that we've backed Blu-ray. We aren't, you know, again, we're always going to be platform agnostic. We happen to think that one technology is the way to go. But hopefully there'll be a resolution of that in the not-too-distant future.
Let's talk about ABC. ABC made $500 million at the peak a few years ago in an operating profit. And the delta's very positive right now, but still got a long way to go. Is that still, given the changes in the TV network business in general, is that still a relevant benchmark as we think about the potential of the network? And also talk about the syndication pipeline. It seems to be building very nicely now that you've got all these hit shows out in the market.
Yeah, I think that We're in a very different place today than we were back in 2000, 2001. And in a way, I was much more nervous then than I am today about where the network is, because you know we had one show that represented 140 hours of programming on the schedule and during the season. And today we've got four very big hit hour shows that are 43 hours roughly each on the schedule. And so it's a much more diversified situation. It's a much better platform from which to grow. And as you pointed out, it's a position where we have much more opportunity for syndication and other ancillary revenue streams. So, I think that the peak of our profitability is certainly something we aspire to, but I'm not going to make predictions about getting there or when or how. I think that you'll see substantial improvement in profitability at ABC this year. And if the trends continue, scatter market is pretty good right now. We're seeing high single-digit kind of pricing over the upfront in scatter. There's always more we'd like to do. We'd like to see greater strength Thursday, Friday, Saturday in our schedule, and we're focusing on that. And we'd like to see the trends continue in our morning programming. But we're well positioned there. You mentioned syndication. You take a look at the TV shows that we've got on the air now and we've had on the air for some time, and we look out over the next 5 years and figure that there's in excess of $1 billion of operating income to come off of syndication and ancillary revenue streams given sort of current market conditions. And obviously if rating trends continue and we build off of that, that's a business that we hope to enjoy well out in the future. And we haven't had that in recent years, so that is additive to what we saw when you go back before 2000, 2001. We had very, very little. We were sort of second cycle of home improvement at that point, and that's what we had in syndication. So,
well, a lot of that profit was built on Millionaire as well, right?
It was basically all driven by the real success of Millionaire. And so it came and went. It was really, really fun while it lasted, but it came and went relatively quickly.
I think the one other place that maybe investors are a little less optimistic in terms of your ability to grow going forward, along with theme parks, is ESPN, given that you've done a couple of high-profile rights deals with the NFL and then with recently with Major League Baseball. So rising cost and I guess just lack of optimism that the advertising revenue can continue to grow. Can you just talk about how confident you are that you can do that double-digit growth?
Well, we feel very good about the double-digit growth target and think that we'll achieve that. And we have a decent amount of certainty given where we are with cable affiliate deals and given where we are with sports rights. Now, today we're announcing a deal with NASCAR, and I think that deal is really representative in a number of ways of the kind of deal that we like to see. Because that deal, which is, the core of it is 17 Nextel races and 35 Busch Series races. The Busch Series will mostly be on ESPN2. But with it comes substantial rights for other platforms. We've got rights to about 5 minutes of video per race to put across mobile and wireless platforms. We've got the ability to do highlights and updates, special shows, special streaming. On our broadband service, we can stream races on ESPN 360. And so it's a business it's a deal that allows us to continue to drive our core business of ESPN and protect that business and grow our viewership and continue to serve our fan base. But it also gives us the capability to reach out through these new platforms to make sure that we're extending our relationship with fans. And it's a delicate balance about how much of the sports rights that are out there we buy and what we pay for them. And obviously these aren't cheap deals. You look at football, baseball, and now NASCAR. The NASCAR deal is consistent with the double-digit growth goal that we put out, so we're still comfortable with that given the deal. We anticipated it in that making those estimations. And I think that it is more about taking ESPN to the next level in terms of serving sports fans Even as a lot of people are talking about the possibility of competing with ESPN on television, I don't think anybody is even vaguely positioned to do what ESPN is in the process of doing, which is extend its brand strength out into the other ancillary revenue streams in a real, in a cohesive and sticky sort of a way.
And from a technological standpoint, I mean, it's always evolving, but in terms of HD, you're pretty much set, right? You've got that invested capital base, and you're taking...
Yeah, we ramped up our capital spending at ESPN over the last several years. We built a digital facility. We're actually in the process of building the secondary digital facility that's a part of that. ESPN, by the way, you know, they really are about $100 million of capital expenditure a year. I think the next few years, $100 to $125 million of capital expenditure is probably a pretty good estimate. So it doesn't just fall back down. There's continued investment that we're going to do there, but it's at a very manageable level. And I think it's the payoff there is going to be substantial in terms of our capabilities and what we can do to really be a full-service sports media company. So,
any thoughts on a la carte pricing? Obviously, every time that issue comes up, which is on the front burner right now, your ESPN is mentioned.
Well, you know, I scratch my head about a la carte pricing primarily because I actually can't figure out how it's possibly consumer friendly. At the end of the day, I think it would limit consumer choice. I think it would potentially make a lot of people's cable bills more expensive for less programming. Because at the end of the day, to provide that quality level of programming, the economic equation has to work, and I actually think people like having choice. The really must-have cable channels like ESPN would become more expensive. People would still buy them. The Disney Channel, same thing. Some of the less powerful channels would be in a much more difficult position vis-a-vis their ability to invest in programming. I'm not sure that's good for consumers at the end of the day. So my gut is that it's not going to come to fruition. If it does, it does, and I think that over time, our brands will continue to cut through. But when all the trends are towards consumers looking for more choice, I'm not sure a la carte actually ultimately gets them there, even if it looks interesting at the outset.
With the MVNO rollout, I think it kicks off at the Super Bowl, or with the Super Bowl, timing-wise.
Right.
But you're in a couple of test markets now, I think three or four. Mm-hmm. Do you have any early returns on the sell-through?
Well, we're cautiously optimistic. I mean, I think that, this is a business where until we get to the critical mass of users and get a lot of feedback, good news, you get real live feedback. Then we get the feedback. It's difficult to make any specific prediction about what it's going to do, but I think it's a good product. I think it's going to be well received. You're right, we kick it off really broadly with the Super Bowl. We've got meaningful interest from folks who want sponsorships because they, I think, recognize the ability through the cell phone to reach out to folks is somewhat unique. And, I think that there's the opportunity for business there. Now, having said that, we're obviously going to invest a fair amount of money. It's going to take three or so years to get to break even in that business. By the way, I think the way to think about it is that beyond the sort of initial entrance, for those of you who are trying to think about the economics, we'll, for every 10,000 subscribers above sort of a minimum number, cost us about $2 million in losses in the first year to acquire and subsidize the first year of use. So, and obviously as we get, hopefully build up subscribers and get to a break-even point, the numbers flip. But there's a few years of investment here. The important thing is that while this doesn't preclude us from being able to license sports content to other mobile carriers, what we can do through the MVNO is have established relationships, direct relationships with consumers or sports fans. And we think that is a very attractive economic proposition down the road if we can make it stick.
Questions from the audience? Yes. Why don't we start right over here? I think there's
behind
a
the podium.
Mic right behind you on its way. Great.
I'm not sure this column in the middle of the room is big enough. It's blocking half the room.
Thanks. Given the recent moves by some of the other companies in the media space, like Time Warner's very large share repurchase program and Viacom's pending breakup into two public companies, can you talk about what you think is both the right capital structure and corporate structure for Disney going forward?
Sure. As we've mentioned recently, starting in about August of 2004, we got back into repurchasing shares, which is a continuation of something we said 3 years ago. We said we want to drive our credit stats back to where we thought they were in a solid A sort of category, and that from there, barring internal or external opportunities that were overly attractive, we turned to share repurchase. And so since then, we've bought nearly 155 million shares, so we've spent a little over $3.9 billion on share repurchase in the last 18 months. And we do have the balance sheet in a position that we are very comfortable. We think our liquidity is good. We think that we have good financial flexibility. And so I think share repurchase is a tool that you could expect us to use in the future. The market has made it an easier decision. It's, from a value standpoint, it's a very easy decision. From an earnings accretion standpoint, it's a very easy decision right now. So we feel good about that. Capital structure, you know, more broadly, we like the integrated nature of our businesses, and we've said that we're looking at the possibility of divesting our radio business if we can do it in a way that we think drives more value that way than continuing to own it. And if we're right about that, then that's a transaction that we would do. That's obviously a small piece of the puzzle. We'll continue to look aggressively at the issue of capital allocation and where we think we can get the best returns. Right now, at least for our company, we don't think a wholesale split apart of broadcasting from cable or studio and parks from something else makes sense. As I said, we like the integrated nature of the business. We think that there are some interesting opportunities in some of the businesses. You know, you take the ABC network, for example. What's happening there is that since the beginning of network television, hit shows have created tremendous community and sort of interest around them. And what we have today is an environment where it's possible, and nobody's cracked the code on it yet, but it's possible to better capture the community around those shows. That's something we're looking at very hard, and the folks we have over at ABC are thinking about that every day. And to the extent that you have four or five big hit shows like we have, and we can capture the community and the user published content there, I think there's some attractive opportunities to better leverage the great affinity people have with those programs. And so we're still intrigued with some of those types of prospects, and we think that as a whole, being able to sort of aggregate some of that traffic and those potential impressions right now offers enough prospects that it makes sense to continue the course as is.
Larry.
Tom, over the years, the industry and Disney in general have spent a lot of time and effort trying to do business in China without a great amount of success. We now, as a country, have a tremendous trade deficit with China, and you've got a foothold in Hong Kong, which is a special administrative region. And yet it seems, in having conversations with people, that it's getting more and more difficult to open the door to get these folks to actually pay for the content. Could you bring us up to date on what's going on there as you see it, and whether or not there's any hope of ever getting significant revenue in this region and cash flow?
Well, I think here again, I do like the way our company is positioned. For those of you who are less familiar, the activities we've got going in China are actually pretty diverse. Most people realize we've opened the park in Hong Kong, and we're pleased with the way that's ramping up now. And you know, that establishes a beachhead, but we have over 1,800 Disney Corners, which are dedicated retail spaces in stores around China. We've got we're through terrestrial branded television blocks, we're in about 350 million households around China with our content. And so our activities right now are really Disney Publishing is there, et cetera. ESPN is there through ESPN Star. Our activities now are about building our brand presence and building our brand awareness. The type of programming that we offer we think is you know, family friendly. We think that it's not controversial, and we're quite hopeful that we can continue to build on the brand success that we're seeing. And in that marketplace, we're very encouraged with where that's going. I think it'll take some number of years before we really move the needle in terms of earnings, but I think the presence that we're establishing now puts us in very good stead, and that country is going to be very, very important to us. It already is, but it's going to be very, very important to us. When you look 5-10 years out, it's going to be a very big deal, and I think that you know, right now, the second biggest market for us in consumer products, for instance, is Japan. You know, down the road, I think China stands to be to have that distinction if we continue to build the brand that we've started the way we've started to build it.
Why don't we do two more questions? We'll do the first one there.
Tom, in Bob's Wall Street Journal interview a couple of days ago, he mentioned something about expanding theme parks using a smaller type of a format internationally. What exactly did you have in mind?
Well, the we've thought about, I mean, we tested the Adventures by Disney vacation product that we're now rolling out, you know, as an example of how we're looking at trying to extend the Disney name in travel and tourism and family trust in a way that you know, we can both continue to extend our relationship with guests, provide a great experience, and reinforce the brand as a whole while, you know, overall creating value. We're also intrigued with the notion of creating smaller, more self-contained, we call them theme park experiences for want of a better word, but entertainment experiences that avoid some of the pitfalls that we saw in things like Disney Quest. We opened a couple of sort of 50,000 square foot sort of theme park in a box kind of experiences. We saw huge interweek seasonality. You know, the during the week it was just empty and it was overpacked on the weekends. So we're focusing on smaller, broader resort and park type of operations in markets with established tourist base where we can take advantage of that tourist base and also enhance it for those folks. We've kicked around a few things in the drawing board. It's, you know, a little early to talk about specific examples, but sort of the early results of the creative efforts are somewhat encouraging that down the road we might find a way to have a Disney-branded half-day or full-day experience in markets that might not support an overall theme park that we can support with partners, probably with limited capital investment, and that continue to build the brand name around the world.
Let me take one last question, if we have one. Any closing thoughts?
Well, I think that, as I said, when I look at where the company is today, the thing that has us most excited is not just the momentum that we see, but how the company's positioned to take advantage of what's going on in the marketplace, whether it's the positioning of the brands, new technology, or the positioning of the theme parks in terms of, you know, the competitive advantage that they have. And the other businesses, the opportunity we now see in video games, for example. Narnia video game is out. It's selling quite well. It's been very well reviewed. The more rich content that goes into video games, the more it plays to our strengths. And so we've just lost the lights for those of you at home, so if you're wondering why everyone's chuckling. And so the, you know, I think
fade out.
Yeah, I think that the future looks pretty bright, and we're excited about where the company sits today, but we're more excited about where the company's going.
Right. Tom, thank you.
Thanks.